As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, well, we'll review some of our predictions for the season that was. Where were we right? Where did we maybe sometimes go wrong? We will also talk about some of those big new signings in the Premier League. Darwin Nunez to Liverpool, Erling Haaland to Manchester City. But what next for Chelsea's Romelu Lukaku? And of course, we will dissect everything that happened when it comes to England's performances in the Nations League. This is The Game. Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Hugh Wizencroft alongside Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson for what is officially the final episode of the season. Yeah, when you look back on Soccer Base, this will be the final episode, all right? And then we'll flip over. You'll have to hit that switch to go to the next season because from here on out, and we will be covering the Women's Euros, it will officially be the Game Podcast 2022-23 season. Okay, so on this episode we will look back at some of our predictions. We'll do a little quiz at the end. There's some stuff for us to talk about before we get there, but it'll be a lot of fun, hopefully, won't it, gentlemen? Anyway, let's start with the negatives, if you like. England thrashed 4-0 by Hungary to round off what was a thoroughly miserable first four games in the Nations League. Two defeats, two draws, no goals from open play. New formations were trialled by the manager, Gareth Southgate. New players were given an opportunity. But what I want to ask you two is, what did we learn about England in these four games? Tom Clark.
We learned that people still really don't like Gareth Southgate, do they?
That's lesson one.
As much as my endless campaign continues. I would say the left-back situation is a big, big problem. I was going to start with they can't score goals, but that felt a little bit obvious. The left-back situation is a problem. Luke Shaw's form, Ben Chilwell's injuries are something that Gareth Southgate's going to be really hoping comes back into prominence in the new season before the World Cup.
I like what you're doing here, Tom. I like what you're doing here. Because you don't want to get involved in the headline arguments. You went, what's the most obscure one I can select?
I wouldn't say obscure.
Let's start with the left-back area. We've had our two first choice left-backs injured.
I wouldn't say obscure.
So we've had to choose makeshifts.
That's the issue for you, is it? It's certainly mid-ranking, definitely. I mean, yeah. But sure, I might have gone a bit more left field. That's certain. Look, goals are a problem, aren't they? I was pretty astonished by that game, like everyone else, particularly having recorded the previous podcast and said, just it'll be fine, don't worry about it. And I remember even during that podcast thinking, I'm going to say that they'll thrash Hungary and everyone will be back on side by the end of the week. And obviously that's not the case. The other reason for going slightly left field and talking about left backs is that I just can't get on board with the frantic, frenzied, panicking, the idea that we should change the manager, all the kind of stuff that's coming around. So,
are you still then of the opinion that these four matches in the Nations League are irrelevant, doesn't matter?
Not irrelevant, but actually in a strange way, I think you could make the argument that getting the poor performances out of the way, also at a time of the season when, I mean, you said it there in your intro, it's been the most endless football season in the history of all football seasons.
I don't think I did, but that's clearly what you felt.
It certainly sounded like it.
You hear what you want.
You were saying, what a dangerous suggestion that we're in such a close relationship here. No, but that feeling of we're finally at the end, that was what I took from your intro, Hugh, that it's been a long, long old season. And I do think, as much as people say, oh, there's loads of talent in the squad, there's got to be a factor. It's got to be in some of these performances. The players look jaded. You know, the little sprints to get the ball, you know, the ball's over the top, people not making the runs. It's all part of it. you asked me what we learned. We learned that it's been a long football season, that people don't like Gareth Southgate, that England do need to work out how to score goals, but I wouldn't be too worried about it. I don't think it's irrelevant, but I think in a strange way, it's a warning that Southgate and the players will correct by the time the World Cup comes around.
Gregor, you've had more time to think about the answer, so hopefully you don't say the left-back area as well.
No, I think the first thing we learned is that you guys are all mental in England.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting at. That's kind of what I was getting at, but I can't say it was as much gravitas without a Scottish accent.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is peculiar to watch from a neutral point of view, the sort of hysteria. Look, I'm not it was a humbling night. You don't need me to tell you that, and it was a shocking performance, and particularly at the back, like, just players who you see in the Premier League being certainly a lot better than that, just all at sea. It was a mess. But I think the biggest thing you've learned is that the sort of the atmosphere is on a knife edge. I think it always was. I think it was through your run to the final in the Euros. It was. You know, I remember citing at the time the game against Germany. There was, like, you take a little look at social media at half time, and you're hearing all the sort of vitriol leveled at Southgate. Then you go and win, and then he's nearly Sir Gareth. Like, it's always been like that. It's always been like that with England, but it seems to be particularly, even more so, I think, at the moment. And this idea that you have a golden generation that's going to be wasted, certainly in my lifetime, you've always had a golden generation that's going to be wasted. I think that's a waste of time thinking like that. I do think you need some perspective. You know, it's easy for me to say that as a Scotsman, having watched us been very fortunate to beat Armenia with 9 men. I do think you need some perspective, because what Gareth Southgate has done is more than anyone's done for 50 years.
I think, trying to answer your question in a more rounded and less rambling way, Hugh, I think what we've learned is that perhaps this World Cup will be the last thing Gareth Southgate does as an England manager. And I'm not saying that in an extreme way, but I'm relating it back to Gregor's question. And I think you either go with the positive of what Gregor said of Sir Gareth, we trust, what an amazing guy, and he wins the World Cup, in which case he goes, thanks very much, this is as good as it's ever going to get, I'm going to go and try and get a top six, you know, top half Premier League job. Or it, you know, goes out in the quarters, even the semi-finals, and it would generally be seen as a failure with this bunch of players, and it'll be time to move on, and it'll all be mutual consent, and it'll all be, you know, parted ways amicably. But it does get that feeling now that there are lots of questions for him to answer in terms of how the players are performing, systems, formations. But I believe that he can get that right. But I also believe that now, even if he does get it right, the World Cup could still be the end of his England career.
I also think that England suffer from having the best league in the world and the best managers managing in that league. Mm. And it's unrealistic to expect England to play the same kind of buccaneering football that you see from a Man City or a Liverpool. It's not going to happen. And I also think there's so much talk about his position. I think it's really important that you have a look around and see who else is going to be the England manager right now.
As soon as the rumours that Pochettino was leaving Paris Saint-Germain, people were tweeting saying, make it Poch, make it Poch. That's all I'm saying. That is exactly what happened. Listen, I think the Nations League campaign was massively instructive. I think we learned so much, mostly about what England aren't rather than what they are. But I still think that's important, because all the arguments about formation, I think, they should go out the window. If you watch those few games, we tried the 4-2-3-1, we tried the one holding midfielder, we lost 4-0 in that game. We just aren't a good enough side, generally speaking, and whether you put that down to the manager or not, to go and dominate games and control games and play beautiful football. That's just, you can talk about the quality and the talent in the squad if you want to. There's only 2 matches before the World Cup, and we're not going to become Brazil of 1970 in those 2 matches before we get to the World Cup. And so we've learned that we need to go back to how we played in the Euros. We need to go back to what worked for Gareth Southgate, that got 5 clean sheets all the way up to the semi-finals, that got us into a final and all the way to the penalties. If you want to continue the narrative word that you love, it is what it is. England should be boring. They should be pragmatic. They should play two holding midfielders, and we shouldn't now be arguing about it before the World Cup because they're not good enough, which I may have told you once or twice before. But they aren't, but now we know. At least we tried it out and those questions were answered. England could one day be a great attacking force with the players that they have, but they're just not going to get the reps. They're not going to become a fluent team in two, well, I say warm-up games, in the last two Nations League matches. They're just not, and that's okay. I think that's okay. Let's go and try and win games 2-1 or 1-0 and see where it takes us, because there's still quality in that side, and we can fight our way through the competition if we need to. And maybe that's, you know, the bulldog spirit or whatever, I don't know. But ultimately, they're not going to go out there and outplay teams, outclass top quality teams, and we know that. So let's just move on from it. That's all I think.
But you're talking about pragmatism there, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You're doing it in a slightly jaded and slightly, you know, depressed way.
No. The thing that's jaded me is the arguments about it.
Fine.
Not the actual football itself, because ultimately it's about winning games, and England have done quite well in the last two tournaments.
Yeah.
And we
22
all,
games without losing over 90 minutes this.
Yeah, exactly.
This summer.
And if you talk about how Italy won the tournament, it was in a very similar to way the one you've just outlined. You quite pragmatic. You could argue that France, with all the talent that they had, won the previous World Cup with quite a pragmatic approach and didn't play that well, particularly in the group stages. And that's where I think Gareth Southgate deserves credit, because he's realised that international level in modern football, when you don't, this another fact that we've talked about, Gregor alluded to the Premier League there, you often get these players that they don't play together, and you're talking about modern football and wanting everyone to play like Manchester City and Liverpool. That takes time, that takes training, that takes players knowing each other, players gelling, and you don't get that with England because the Phil Fodens and Harry Kanes and people only play together at England level. Then often, quite often, they drop out of friendlies, they even drop out of Nations League games for injuries and things like that, sometimes injuries that miraculously they've recovered from in time for the big Premier League game 2 weeks later. So it's difficult, and I agree with you, pragmatism is the way, but I do think that you can come back to that for the World Cup, and that's why, as I say, talk of Southgate leaving is absolute nonsense.
There are very few elite managers managing in international football.
But are there better managers than Gareth Southgate in international football?
I don't know. Well, Roberto Mancini won the Euros with Italy and then couldn't get them to the World Cup.
Yeah.
Are there better English managers?
Do they have to be English?
I think the answer is yes. I think the pressure on an overseas manager would just ramp up even further. So there's a broader question about English managers. We've mentioned this before. You know, you don't have any in the Champions League. You don't have... none's ever won the Premier League. Do you even have any in the Europa League? I can't think of one. So who are these managers that are going to come in? People keep talking about Graham Potter. Graham Potter would run a mile from this job. You need Graham Potter on the way down. You need Graham Potter to get a top four job, to do really well, and then signs of him becoming yesterday's man, then he'll take the England job. That's what the England job is. It's too toxic. The best English managers wouldn't want it. And there's not many good English managers around. So I think you need to get behind Gareth Southgate personally. Anyway, that's it.
Listen, I see what you're talking about, but ultimately, if he doesn't get some better performances, goals, you know, look, England's main talent is in the forward areas. If you don't get the best out of those players, you can't, surely the FA can't keep him in that job. We'll see what happens after the World Cup. But not scoring goals against better opposition, obviously, you know, score loads against San Marino and Andorra, etc. But ultimately, against the very best teams, they need to be a better attacking team. All they are currently is a threat. You're more worried about them than what they actually produce. You know, you're talking about a team that scores one goal a game, and usually from a set piece or a penalty. I mean, it needs to be better. That area needs to be better, because if they've got a great defensive record, if they couple that with scoring goals, there is a good chance they'll win the World Cup. It doesn't matter if they play pretty football or not. It doesn't really matter. And, you know, if this is a team that can score two goals against the best opposition, the best teams around, two goals, then they've got a chance of winning the World Cup. That's all they need. They don't need to score four or fives because their defence is that good. But ultimately, they don't control games. They don't create the clear-cut goal-scoring opportunities. I feel like I've said this before. The clear-cut goal-scoring opportunities that you need to win trophies, and he has to solve that, otherwise he won't keep his job. But ultimately, I do think if he gets to the quarterfinals,
the FA will keep him on to the Euros, and there will be a feeling that England can go and win the Euros after that, as you pointed out. Come on, you can't grimace when I say that, having pointed out there's no replacement for him.
No, I know, but I think Gareth Southgate might call it a day himself. I'm with Tom on that. I think you'll, Craig, even if he won the World Cup, that's
well,
it.
If he wins it, definitely he's going. Yeah,
either way, because if he doesn't win it, then, you know, people will be calling for his head, no matter what, even if he does take the handbrake off and play Jack Grealish. He'll still be calling for his head if you don't win the World Cup, because that's three tournaments and being the nearly man.
But surely these games have lowered expectations, surely.
Yeah, which is genius. Absolute genius. That's what we've learned. He's a PR genius. You were saying it on the last podcast, Hugh. He's played us like a fiddle. They probably have lowered expectation, but as Gregor says, the frenzy around England and the expectation is always very high, whether we're playing well or whether we're playing badly. But I do think, just going back to one of the points you made there, Hugh, about scoring goals and the defence, you know, I can remember going into the last Euros debating with you guys about back three, and Gregor saying, you know, why focus on the weakness of your team, because we were talking about Harry Maguire and John Stones and who the hell's going to be the centre-half. But actually, I think some of those things you're talking about and the take the handbrake off, cliche as it's becoming with England, if you did that, you would then become, I think, more open, you know, in terms of against opponents' attacks. Mm. I do think there's something to be said for the fact that we keep clean sheets with a defence that perhaps, particularly at club level, including some defenders that aren't playing that well, it is a product of the fact that the team works quite hard defensively, stays quite rigid at times in terms of structure and formations. But the price you pay for that is that you aren't as fluid going forward.
I think one of the issues is that we have some very good wide players, but we play a formation with wing-backs that asks them to obviously narrow in. And for me, that's an issue as well. I think if you're going to play with the three and the four, then you need to have a one, a number 10, and two up front. Again, what does that do to Harry Kane's role? Because, of course, he plays up front on his own and has done for a long time and played pretty well on his own. So does he have a strike partner? Because ultimately, you know, England going forward, those wing-backs, we could have some excellent wing-backs if Ben Chilwell or Luke Shaw find form. And then, of course, in the right wing-back area, there's going to be a good player. We know there's going to be a good player there, whoever it is. You need to get the ball into the box. You need to have players in the box in that case. It's international football, so again, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. But ultimately, you need a creative player. England don't create enough. So is it going to be Phil Foden as a number 10? Is Mason Mount going to keep that role? And can you push someone into the penalty box alongside Harry Kane? And do we become a different team? I know it sounds weird, if we've got the presence of Kane and, say, Abraham alongside him in the penalty box. Now, again, you're going to... Yeah, everyone winced. I was about to react to it without saying exactly what happened there. Yeah, everyone winced when I said it, okay? But ultimately, you're looking at the formation, and does it work for Raheem Sterling? Really? Does it work for Jack Grealish? Really? Does it help the wing-backs? Like, it's all good saying we're going to play with wing-backs. If they don't get forward, I don't get it, because ultimately those are two of your attacking players. In that system, the wing-backs are two of your attacking players, unless you want to play a flat back five. But then that's not three, four, it's five. Mm. Three, two, if you like, whichever it might be. But ultimately, it would be five at the back. And we don't want to play five at the back. We want a system that can switch from a five at the back defensively to wing-backs that push forward. And ultimately, you end up with a front three or four because Reece James gets down the right-hand side or Ben Chilwell gets down the left and gets the ball in. And that never happens in this formation. I don't see why you wouldn't try that. And that hasn't been tried yet. Like, ultimately, I know it sounds weird, but there's no point playing wingers in a system that's not for wingers. Like, I don't, you know, he has to think, I was going to say outside the box, but actually just, you know, that's not what the
formation's inside the box.
Yeah, exactly. But that, no, do you see what I mean? I know there are a lot of teams that play with the 3-4-3. But when you think of the front three, you're talking about the two wide ones, either side of the striker, being basically inside forwards, attacking midfielders, not out-and-out touchline wingers. So if you're going to play, okay, if you want to stay with the three as the front three, but you play a Phil Foden who has played there and you tuck him in, which I think he'll be more than happy with, is Grealish isn't going to tuck in. And neither's Raheem Sterling. They both play off the touchline. They want space to run at people. But as soon as they go and hug that touchline, what's happening to your wing back?
Like, are they going to make an inverted run? They're obviously not going to overlap, so it's fine. Ultimately, you can do that, but England don't do any of those things. There's none of that movement. There doesn't seem to be any of that thought.
That's what I mean. Some
it's
of those...
too static, constantly static.
The contrast with Germany as well, when you played Germany and they had Musiala and Müller behind Havertz, and Havertz as well, kind of floating as well. So, you know, that kind of fluidity of movement, that was a bit of a glaring contrast. Like we're going around the circles again, whether Southgate can get them to do that or not. If he can't, then he's got to do the best he can with the team.
But I think going back to some of those points and those players, and a good example of the kind of culture clash, if you like, of what we're talking about, pragmatism versus, you know, go for it, unleash these players, is the kind of Trent Alexander-Arnold debate, which will go on endlessly for the rest of his career, probably. And a lot of these moments when, you know, you start getting predicted teams, and Henry's written a piece criticising Southgate, and in it he picks his kind of team that he would have, and he has Trent at right back, which obviously a lot of people would argue you have to have. But you then think about the Euros, and you think about, probably you could make the argument that Kyle Walker was England's most important and best player in terms of consistency and that pragmatism and getting the clean sheets. And then again, so you have those two as a kind of clash at big tournament level. You want to put the superstar in, or do you put the guy who's got loads of international caps, loads of Champions League appearances, and probably always turns up for you in the big games? And then Raheem Sterling, as you say, Hugh, you want to get the best out of him, but then also I think he produces his best for England in big games anyway. We had debates during the Euros where, again, he was England's best player. He was the player who made things happen, as we always say. And he managed to do that within the, you know, the straitjacket, if you like, of Southgate's system. So I just think, you talked about pragmatism earlier, I'd say it's almost redundant to have the debates around people like Trent and the kind of, you know, Southgate's got to go for it, or I just don't think he will, because I don't think that's succeeded before. And I think if you look at the tournaments in the past, he's got success with a pragmatic approach, and I don't think he owes anyone anything other than to go for that again.
Okay. That rounds off our conversation about international football, because we will go round and round in circles, and we'll just lift that conversation. We'll insert it in September when the Nations League games come round again. Anyway, disappointed in England. Ultimately, I think I've been right. They're not going to win the World Cup. If they get past the quarterfinals, we should all be absolutely delighted, and I will maintain that as we go into Qatar next season with lower expectations than we had before. Anyway, still to come on the Game Podcast, we'll be talking about two striking sensations making their way to the Premier League, and we'll do a bit of a quiz and look back at some of the predictions we made a little bit earlier on during the campaign. But remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, rate us, leave us a review, and make sure you're subscribed. Since we last spoke, we've had the confirmation of two signings and two figures who could play starring roles in the Premier League for many years to come. Darwin Nunez joins Liverpool from Benfica, £64 million up front, £21 million of potential add-ons after 34 goals in 41 games in all competitions last season. And Erling Haaland was finally unveiled to the Manchester City fans after his £51.2 million move from Borussia Dortmund, where he scored 86 goals in 89 games, not last season, at the club. I think these are two fantastic signings. I think it's once again showing us just how hard it's going to be to catch Manchester City and Liverpool. I think the good thing looking at Liverpool as a Manchester United fan is that for them, they need to strike while the iron's hot, which is that at the moment they're sitting very close to the top, if not at the top of European football. And so you are a very attractive prospect, and you've got a fantastic manager. And you might not have a fantastic manager forever, because you don't pay the biggest money in the world to your players. You don't pay the biggest money in the world for all of your signings either. But what you can do is use the fact that people want to play for your club right now. Exciting football, successful football. And I think this is a great addition to that forward line. We'll come to what it means for the futures of some of their players in a moment. I think when it comes to Manchester City, this was the smart money. I don't necessarily think Pep Guardiola thinks he's a better player than Harry Kane, but he has the longevity, and he has the, you know, as a young player, you have the ability to mould him a little bit more and shape him than Harry Kane's game, which I think still would have fit Manchester City, actually. I mean, these two could be, you know, this could be two of the names that we talk about in English football for a long, long time. You excited by it, Tom?
I am. I think what I'm most excited about from the point of view of being a bit of a tactical geek, is that I think there are, and you alluded to it there, I think these two players are a sign that there could be quite a lot of changes for both these clubs this season, or the next season, in terms of how they play, how they set up, what it'll mean for other players who've been established and won trophies for them for the last few seasons. So I'm really intrigued to see how it'll all pan out. I think it's not as simplistic. I've seen a lot of coverage of the fact that obviously Haaland and Nunes are both tall, bigger strikers who, you know, play centrally. It's like, oh, it's the return of the big man up front. It's great. I think it's a little bit more sophisticated than that. Well, maybe it won't be. Maybe it won't be. Maybe it'll just get it wide, get it in the box, and they'll both score about 25 goals, half of them with their head. That'd be great to see. But I don't think it will be like that.
Well, Liverpool don't mind getting it into the box already, so that's good for them, the likes of Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Yeah, that's great.
Trent Alexander-Arnold's tweet when he said, welcome, Darwin, how may I assist you?
Very good. But I do think there will be some interesting tweaks in terms of systems and personnel who will play a bigger and or lesser part for both of those teams. So that's what I'm excited about. As much as they are both star names, I don't necessarily know whether they'll both just kind of come crashing through and they'll both have 15, 20 goals by Christmas. I could be wrong, but I would be more, you know, intrigued to see how they're both going to be moulded by their managers and how their teams are going to be made to fit around them.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated by the potential impact of Haaland on City's team. Liverpool, it's more just the kind of evolution that, you know, you see how well-oiled this machine is. And in the last 2 years, is it even 2 years? They've signed Jota, who's 25 and has the best football ahead of him. Luis Diaz, who's 25 and has made a remarkable impact already. And, you know, a 22-year-old who is right with potential as well. So, you know, alongside Salah. So that's your four. For a long time, their kind of backup for the front three has been was Origi. So I think they've upgraded somehow, despite the sort of imminent loss of Sadio Mane. So for Liverpool, it's like the evolution. But Haaland, his game's all about impact. That's just, you just can't wait to see him in the Premier League, brushing defenders off and plundering goals. I can't see him doing anything else, personally.
I think there's more evolution here for Liverpool than there is for Manchester City.
Really?
I don't necessarily think Liverpool are stronger for next season. In the long term, I imagine they will be. But for next season, I think it's going to be, you know, if this was a player like Roberto Firmino, and you could say, look, his game, you know, what Firmino did with the two wingers, Salah and Mane, could they replicate that with a new front three in the same style? I don't think Darwin Nunes is that type of player. He just isn't, in fact, watching him. You know, I know a lot of people describe him as a mix of Luis Suarez and Edinson Cavani.
He isn't so far, but we're talking about them both being young and having
I'm not saying that Liverpool in the long term won't be better with, I think, a player who is more relevant in terms of his physical attributes to being a goal scorer in the Premier League than Roberto Firmino. He's a lovely player, but he doesn't have that explosive nature to his game that I think Darwin Nunes has at still 22 years old. So I'm still excited to see it. But I think next season, it will take some time for them to gel in a new system. I also think, you know, when Mane leaves, okay, I think it'll be Luis Diaz on the left-hand side. He'll be guaranteed that place. It'll be Salah. Will it be Nunes? Definitely through the middle. How much football will Jota want to play? I think at Manchester City, we know that Haaland's going to start through the middle immediately, and it'll be a case of working things out. I don't think he'll hit the ground running in a particular way in terms of the style of football at Manchester City. I think he, like Mahrez, like Grealish, will take time to be moulded into that style of play. However, I just think they create so many chances that the stats will be there that we won't realise. Do you see what I mean? Mm. Like how much more there is to go. He will still score 20 goals and we'll all say, what a great first season in the Premier League. How many players find it hard to adjust, etc. And we'll be praising him. And Nunes might not score as many goals. They don't have a problem scoring goals, Liverpool, and I'm sure he'll get his fair share. But in terms of their link-up play and his movement up front, they are going to have to change tack slightly, very slightly. I don't think he's going to come short as much as some of their other players do who are natural midfielders, or Firmino, who's a false nine. He's not. He's going to go in behind. And usually that's their wide players. So there's a tweak there.
He can play wide.
Yeah.
And you know, Jota, one of the things about Jota when he first arrived was his ability to play that, really, the Firmino role. Mm. So He's a very kind of adaptable player. So you know, look, that's what I mean. There's so many options and you know, so much potential for Liverpool's front line now. City, it's just all about the impact he makes, whether he's going to come, as you say, whether he's going to hit the ground running. I just think that, you know, there might be some tweaks, particularly against stronger opposition. He's going to have to press. City have done so well by having that extra player, you know, because they haven't played with an out and out striker, that extra player to kind of drop deep and they dominate numbers just in front of the opposition's back four almost, and they have players running, going and beyond. This is much more kind of traditional, a focal point for defenders to try and get a grip off, which is arguably easier, but he's Erling Haaland. He's not going to be easy to defend against.
Yeah.
And I just think he's going to get so many, as you say, so many opportunities that he will score goals.
I should say that Tom Roddy joins us now from The Times on the Game podcast. We'll be talking about Romelu Lukaku very shortly and what might be happening with his future. But Tom, what's your opinion on these two moves? And what do you think about what we've had to say so far? Who do you think is going to have maybe more of an impact in this first year?
Probably Darwin Nunez for me, Hugh. And part of the reason is because with Erling Haaland, we know, even though he's young, he's actually moved around a hell of a lot. I mean, Mulder to RB Salzburg to Dortmund. He's used to moving from dressing room. So I don't think he's going to have any issue settling in to a new country, to a new dressing room at all. What he may have an issue with is adapting to Pep Guardiola's style of play. It takes time. We've seen that with Raheem Sterling, we saw it with Jack Grealish just this year. So it takes that little bit of time. I think Darwin Nunez can fit into the Liverpool team far easier. And it's interesting, you at the top of this, Hugh, you mentioned about the suitability of each player, but and how Liverpool were attractive to players. And that's kind of their big selling point at the moment, because part of that is because they can't compete with City financially. So they looked at Haaland, they looked at Kylian Mbappe, but when you actually see the numbers, they can't do that. So they're then shopping in the market of players like Darwin Nunez, who maybe at the moment aren't quite on the bracket of Haaland on the world stage, but are, from a football point of view, one of the most attractive clubs to play for right now.
It's going to be interesting to see them. It's more additions to the Super League. Sorry, the Premier League. as we get more and more of these superstars next season. One superstar, Tom, that came into the Premier League, back into the Premier League at the start of last season, really didn't deliver, and we had very high hopes for, in the shape of Romelu Lukaku at Chelsea. And you've been writing in The Times that he's on his way very, very soon, if not already, on loan to Inter Milan, which I've got to say, this really surprises me. I just don't know why Chelsea would do this. You've written Chelsea don't want to sell him. You've also written that Lukaku isn't ready to leave permanently. So it might seem obvious to everyone else, but I'm confused. Why is this happening?
Well, yeah, you're right, Hugh. After talking about Nunez and Haaland and the hype of those two transfers, here's a sort of tale of expectation and reality. But there was Lukaku had a meeting last week with the new ownership. It was one which had been planned for a long time, and the outcome of that meeting was that a solution is needed. And part of it, I think, with Lukaku leaving on a permanent basis is because of the figures involved. I mean, when you think they paid £97.5 million for him last year, who is going to pay that amount of money? So Chelsea essentially are looking at a significant loss. Now, Lukaku has always said that Chelsea is his club, the one in England anyway, is his club and the one he's supported since a child. Didier Drogba was his hero, et cetera, et cetera. And so he's wanted this to work. I wonder whether the solution is Inter for a year because the situation with Thomas Tuchel has been quite fracturous. That relationship was pretty broken after the infamous Sky Italia interview in December, which ironically that was when we started to see the real potential of Lukaku. That period between Christmas and New Year, he played really well. The interview was recorded and it was broadcast just before New Year, and it just saw his form nosedive. And since then, the relationship with Tuchel hasn't been particularly great. And my suspicion is that the idea is a year away. What is the lifespan of a coach in the Premier League outside Liverpool and Man City in the last few years? It tends to be 18 months, 2 years. At Chelsea, it certainly tends to be that. Who knows what it'll be in the new Todd Bowley era, but it tends to be that. If Thomas Tuchel is gone this time next year, Romelu Lukaku comes back under a new coach and it's a fresh start. So that's my suspicion, that is the hope, that is the potential solution. And of course, it's a win-win for Inter. They get him back on loan, the guy who scored 30 goals to take them to the Scudetto the season before last. And but one thing just to say to you, this is definitely not a done deal yet at all. Okay. They are in talks, the two clubs, they are in talks, and there's still a way to go at the moment.
Okay, we'll see what happens with Romelu Lukaku. I should have pointed you to two articles that you can read. Henry Winter back in May, quite an interesting one. I was reading it this morning. Goal scoring machine Erling Haaland will only get better under Pep Guardiola. And Paul Joyt has written this week about the footage that put Jurgen Klopp on the trail of £64 million striker Darwin Nunez. So make sure you check those two out, and what Tom, of course, has been writing about Chelsea and more in the Times. Listen, before we move on, a little bit later on, in fact, probably next up, we will be reacting to some of our predictions from earlier on in the season. And Tom Roddy, since we've got you here, we've got to broach some of what you had to say, okay? We're going to begin with the reaction of both Tom and Jonathan Northcroft to Manchester United signing Cristiano Ronaldo.
I think United have had a transformative window. Will it be enough? I don't know. But they're now. I think the Ronaldo signing right at the end just puts him in the mix. And I know he's 57 years old, but he's Cristiano Ronaldo.
If Chelsea hadn't done the business they've done, I still would have expected them to be a contender for the title. But United's, what they've done by bringing in Ronaldo and the quality of Varane, they've turned themselves into title contenders overnight.
I mean, how poor was that?
And they ruined it. They were title contenders. Look at that squad, and they just ruined it. I stand by it entirely.
He's doubling down. Unbelievable scenes. We're going to hear more from what Tom Roddy and the others have had to say next, but I just firstly can't believe that. I did say they weren't title contenders, right? I
mean, you did also say that Ronaldo was the signing of the season, though. Hopefully we've got that clip lined up.
Was he not?
Absolutely not.
He was in the conversation.
No,
wasn't
he wasn't.
He was.
Anyway, let's
where would Man United have been without him?
Probably about the same, which is what I said when they signed him, by the way.
Absolutely not.
Hello to all the Twitter followers that and the abuse I got at the start of the season.
I'm staying quiet because I know there's going to be some
We're going to have more of our predictions, good and bad, by the way, coming up on the Game Podcast. Tom Roddy, thank you for joining us. Stay with us. We'll have a big quiz on the way as well. So the first appalling prediction is out of the way. Thank you, Tom Roddy, for putting up with us. I've got Tom Clark and Gregor Robertson still with me. And we're going to go through some of the other predictions that we have made, not just us, but others on the Game Podcast this season, see how they worked out. We were talking about Manchester United a few moments ago and what Tom Roddy and Jonathan saw in their future. Let's take Gregor into the crystal ball.
I think we're going to see a headline where saying Solskjaer tops of the table with Manchester United, and then 2 to 3 months later, pressure rising on Solskjaer, Solskjaer facing the axe. I think that cycle is going to continue.
We were asking for headlines, and Gregor couldn't actually think of what a headline was. So that was his headline. He just basically said, and I, at the end I said, so what you're saying is Ollie out, and something like that, I think. And ultimately it was about Solskjaer getting sacked. Which I don't know if that's a great prediction or not, to be perfectly honest, but you're the only person that said it, Gregor Robertson. So kudos to you. You were right. Ollie on his way out. How are you feeling?
I think you're giving me far too much credit there. I thought it was going to be... Ollie would have had to done something disastrous to be getting the sack, and it turned out he did.
Yeah, it was disastrous, wasn't it? Next one is me. I'm sure it's a good one. Let's have a listen.
I think Brighton, for me, could be overachievers. They're the team that I've picked. They just need to put the ball in the back of the net, not change much, sign a decent striker. You know, hardest thing to do in the game, put the ball in the back of the net. We all know that. But I think if they can get a goal scorer, they probably, for me, will be in the top half. So I'll choose Brighton as mine.
Yes! Ninth-placed finish.
I'm sensing fix here.
The best in their history. Yes, another great prediction from myself, Hughes and Croft, around what was going to... Thank you very much.
I knew I should have been more involved in this process. And I'm
Seagulls
not.
Fans, you know, I'm just saying. I saw it coming.
You're still right about the goal scorer, though.
I am.
You could make that same prediction next season. In fact, maybe just clip it up and do the same thing again if they've not signed anyone in the summer.
I am, but I'd have to go harder than top half. I'm going to have to say, like, top six if they sign a goal scorer. I still can't believe... I've got to say, I can't believe they didn't sign one. So maybe this summer, Brighton fans, fingers crossed. All right, let's talk about Paris Saint-Germain next.
I think there'll be no bigger story than PSG this year. And I'm thinking Pochettino or Poch job. Yeah, you know, he loses Sergio Ramos to a season-long injury. Then he loses Verratti to a long injury. The entire front five refused to track back. And... most of them aren't passing to each other. Wijnaldum's knackered and they get eliminated by a very sort of clever Bayern Munich team from the Champions League in the round of 16 and it all blows up. And I think I think that's the way it's going to end at PSG.
That was incredible.
That's impressive.
I mean, honestly, had he said the actual team that knocked them out, that was the only thing he missed. Had he said Real Madrid... And knocking them out. That would have been the most incredible prediction because he had two injuries in there, accurately. Sergio Ramos barely played all season. Verratti, long-term injury. We know the forwards never track back. Poch is losing his job now. I mean, sensational. He was right.
I mean, Johnny's a witty and very intelligent man. We should also just point out, though,
that
in the Tom Roddy clip, there was also Johnny saying that Ollie was going to take the boys to the title. So let's not just forget that. You know, okay. I'd say it's 1-1 for Northcroft at the minute.
Okay, all right. Well, I still think that's the strongest so far. Let's hear who Gregor chose for his surprise package of the season.
Oh. I think Norwich. I think it probably will be a surprise to many because of the kind of humiliating way that they were relegated last season. They lost their last 10 games. He's kind of done something to tweak it a bit and shore up the defence, and I think that might be enough for them. I think Norwich might surprise a few.
Oh, that's so good.
Gregor, they let you down.
Yeah.
It was the Billy Gilmore that did it, wasn't it? It was that signing.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Billy Gilmore finished top half. I think there was sound reasoning. I watched Norwich in the Championship. They shored the defence up. I thought Stuart Webber was, you know, kind of... I thought he'd done something different. They'd spent money. Everybody slagged them off for not spending money. They did spend money. Yeah. They just spent it really badly, unfortunately. Yeah,
yeah.
So
I listened to that in full, and you did base that on the fact that they'd finally decided to get some money out and spend 50 million quid. And it was spent badly. It was spent badly, and they are back in the Championship. But listen, I'm looking forward to our prediction show for next season, by the way, because I'm sure there'll be more corkers. Up next, we had a conversation about who had got the best manager. Because within the space of about a week, Aston Villa, Norwich and Newcastle appointed new bosses.
Who out of the three clubs, Norwich, Villa or Newcastle, got the best boss?
Dean Smith is a really, really smart appointment. And so I'll go for Dean Smith because I know Greg is going to pick his best mate, Stevie G. the greatest English manager to have ever lived.
I think Steven Gerrard is going to be a success.
I'm tempted to say Eddie Howe.
Well, you've got to now.
With the squad that they've got now and the manager that they have now, they can put together good performances and good results, and we can see them in mid-table.
It's an absolute fix.
Newcastle to finish mid-table.
I'm
says.
Sure if we went back to the point he was appointed as well, you were hammering him.
I was.
You can't flip quite easily in this game.
You heard the facts there in black and white. I don't know what that means, but you heard them there, okay, in great sound quality. And ultimately, I said they was finishing mid-table Newcastle, and I said they got the best manager. So I win that conversation. Mm. You were wrong.
I mean, look, I still stand by. I still think it's a good appointment.
Okay.
I know they went down. But.
And Steven Gerrard, by the way, I'm worried about for next season. They're spending some money. They're getting some players in. He didn't really put up any trees. And I've got to say, he has to improve for next season. That's all I'm going to say. He has to. Because there's a lot of money being spent. There's good players coming in. And he's not going to have many excuses. Finally, we had a conversation about the out-of-work Antonio Conte.
I think Antonio Conte might take a two-year deal at Arsenal to see what he can do with that squad, but of course he'll want a bit of money. But if he was happy to take the Tottenham job, I'm just saying.
This is a fix.
You know what? That actually went on to say, I think he'd end up in North London. This, I mean, I've been, you know.
This is an absolute fix.
I'm just saying, guys, there are a lot of great predictions from Woozy. I'm just gonna put it out there.
It's unbelievable. Okay. I thought the producer John had put this list together. I didn't realise you'd done it.
Yeah, heavily influenced.
Guys, I just did a little bit of editorial help, as I always do, chipping in, doing my work for the team. And all I'm going to say is I think I'm the best at predictions.
I mean, with that heavily edited list, yeah, perhaps.
Okay. All right. Now, before we end the podcast, we're going to have a bit of fun. This is going to get competitive. In fact, I need a pen and paper. So you won't hear me go and get the pen and paper, but I'm going to go and get a pen and paper. Stay there.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
As if by magic there is a pen and a piece of paper in front of me. I'm very fast. Listen, I'm going to do this head to head, okay? Gregor against Tom. So you know, you're feeling bad after the predictions, but one of you will go home with some sort of Times branded mug, which I'm going to steal from downstairs in the canteen. We're going to start with you, Tom, I think. Hopefully they'll put some Mastermind music in after this.
I really hope they don't.
And we'll have some background dramatic music that comes in now. Arsenal were beaten on the opening day of the season by which team?
Brentford.
That's correct. Gregor, who was the first Premier League manager to be sacked this season?
Nuno.
Incorrect.
Damn.
Zisco Munoz, Watford.
Oh, Jesus. Unlucky, that was tough. I wouldn't have got that.
Tom, your second question. Harry Kane scored his first Premier League goal of the season in a 3-2 win at Newcastle, which came on the 17th of which month?
Oh, there's always the thing about how he never scores in August. August.
Incorrect. The answer is October.
Ah, I was going to say that.
October, Harry Kane's first Premier League goal. Gregor, Kane's second Premier League goal came on the 19th of which month?
October.
It was December.
Was it?
Yeah. His second Premier League goal was on the 19th of December.
Really?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Tom.
Right.
Real Madrid was shocked 2-1 at home by Sheriff Tiraspol on match day 2 of the Champions League. But which country are Sheriff from?
Romania.
Incorrect.
Oh, bollocks.
It's Moldova.
It's not going well, this, is it?
Not going well at all.
I think you're 1-0 up, though.
Holding on.
Gregor. Which eventual league winners finished bottom of Liverpool's Champions League group?
AC Milan.
That's correct.
Oh,
he levels it up at 1-1.
Good, he started the second half strong.
Tom, Manchester City scored at least 5 goals on 11 occasions in all competitions. But what was their biggest win in the Premier League and against who? Half a point for each.
7-0.
Half a point?
Norwich.
Nah, it was Leeds United.
Ah, damn it.
But you move on to 1.5. Gregor, you're still on 1. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was sacked following a defeat by which team and which scoreline? Half a point each.
Can I not have this one? I know this one.
I want to see Brighton. But I can see by your face that's wrong, so I don't want to see Brighton. Was it after the Liverpool mauling? I think it was.
Is that your final answer?
I'll go with that. I don't know. Go on.
Unbelievable. I thought this was the easiest question in the whole thing. The answer was Watford, 4-1.
God, yeah. There was a lot of really bad results for Man United in those days, wasn't there?
Tom, Nottingham Forest beat which Premier League side 4-1 in the FA Cup fourth round?
Oh, why didn't you ask me about the third round, for God's sake?
Completely gone. Aston Villa.
Leicester City.
Ah,
Gregor, Kidderminster Harriers took which Premier League side to the 121st minute in the FA Cup fourth round?
See, I know this one again. You're asking me the wrong questions.
Luckily for Gregor, otherwise he'd be 5-0 down at this point in time.
I'm the same. I could have got the question. Oh, no. Kidderminster Harriers against... I don't know. I want to see Newcastle.
West Ham United.
Oh, God, honestly, I remember it now, yeah.
I thought these were all
Declan
easy
Rice
questions.
Declan Rice went in afterwards, didn't he? I remember.
Tom, easier question for you.
Oh, don't tee it up like that. That's even worse.
Chelsea suffered a shock exit in the Women's Champions League. But at which stage?
Group stage?
That is correct. 2.5 to Gregor's 1. Gregor, in March, Arsenal's Viviana Miedema became the first WSL player to reach what somewhat obscure landmark?
Ooh.
I'll give you a clue. It's a combination of things.
That's a clue. I don't know. You're killing me here.
The answer is 100 goal contributions, 70 goals, 30 assists.
That's an extremely modern landmark, isn't it?
It is. I gave you a clue. I said it was a combination of things. Fine. I'm not even sure Gregor can equalise. Oh no, two questions left each. Tom, who lost more Premier League games this season? Manchester City or Liverpool?
City.
That is correct.
Yep.
3.5 to your 1, Gregor. You need to get... In fact, you've already lost, but...
Play to the end, come on.
Let's play it to the end. Gregor, who won more Premier League games? Spurs or Chelsea?
Chelsea.
Spurs. It's not your day, mate. Tom, which player was sent off after 2 yellow cards in 31 seconds at the Etihad in December?
Raul Jimenez.
That is correct. He's storming to the conclusion here.
Finish him.
Gregor, Manchester City's 5-1 win at Wolves in May meant they became the first team in English top flight history to do what?
That is a tougher question than my last question.
I'll give you a clue. I'll give you a clue. It happened in 5 straight games.
It'll be like score more than 3 goals or something.
Winning by a margin of at least 3 goals.
Okay.
I'll give you that. There was a tiebreaker.
I also we came into this, the listeners should know that I thought this was going to be kind of fun. I thought we'd all get picked on with the predictions thing. I also thought we were all doing a quiz.
Woozy's
just teed it up for himself to look a genius and then ask a load of difficult questions for us.
I really thought they were easy questions, I promise you guys. The tiebreaker was how many Premier League goals did ninth placed Brighton score?
How many Premier League goals?
Yeah. 38 games, obviously.
46.
48.
Tom, you're closest. The answer was 42. Right, if you want to answer me some questions.
Well, I just thought we were having a couple of questions each, but I've got an FA Cup, just 3 FA Cup questions
for
you.
Okay, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it.
150th year. Had a lot of excitement. I remember you getting very, very excited about it, saying all the knockouts. But how many Premier League clubs were knocked out in the third round?
5.
6.
Oh, I was going to say 6. Damn!
One of the biggest upsets of that third round was Cambridge United's 1-0 win at Newcastle. Who scored their winning goal?
Ironside.
Yeah, I'll give you that. Joe Ironside.
Impressive.
And then finally, what do Manchester City's Riyad Mahrez and Charlton's Jadon Stockley have in common from this year's FA Cup?
I'm not even sure I've got the right year here. I was going to say scored against Exeter.
No. It's quite simple.
Jaden Stockley.
Riyad Mahrez. You're overthinking it.
And Riyad Mahrez. I don't know. They both scored penalties at Wembley?
No. They were the joint top scorers in the competition.
Oh. How many?
Four each.
Oh, I see. That was good.
Thanks.
That was tough. I got one.
It also makes, you know, Gregor feel better and makes me look like a genius.
I thought those were very good questions, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I've enjoyed the season. Was there a high point for you?
I thought the high point was going to be listening back to our predictions and things, but no, that wasn't as enjoyable as I thought.
Come on, your beloved Lincoln.
I think that should be a personal highlight that I've done well to mention them a lot less this season.
Yeah, I'd say that as well.
I've grown as a podcaster over the season.
You got to go back, come on, in the flesh. That was a special moment, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was great. But I wasn't, you know, that wasn't part of the podcast, was it? Or did I manage to sneak that in?
Yeah, no. It doesn't have to be part of the podcast for it to be the high point of your season.
Oh, a special point in the season generally. Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, Lincoln were pretty poor this season. Tough to say.
Robbo?
I have to say, Celtic snatching the league back under Big Ange and playing some Buccaneering football. Loved it.
And mine was the sacking of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, obviously, because, I mean, come on, that was just like, we spoke about it for 2.5 years straight,
conversation. That was true, actually, yeah. Not
unburdened now of talking about Solskjaer's future,
actually,
fantastic.
One of my highlights was giving you that cupcake for managing to wake it the whole way through a podcast without mentioning Manchester United.
Thank you.
That was maybe my highlight.
Thank you. And mine was you turning down the cupcake that I
brought. You'd still not let that go.
No, I will never let that go. Anyway, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for listening throughout the season. Much more to come, by the way. We will have some special podcasts over the next few weeks, keeping track of everything in the Women's Euros. So keep a lookout for that. Make sure you're subscribed. Hit the button. You won't miss any of those episodes. And then we will be back very, very soon for the early start in July of the season ahead of the build-up to that World Cup in Qatar. But thank you all for listening. Make sure you give us a follow, by the way, at TimeSport. And make sure you are subscribed. Check it out at thetimes.co.uk/thegame. We'll see you soon. Enjoy your summer.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.